This program is sponsored by the United States Naval Institute. The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents for a discussion by author Tom Hone on his book entitled The Battle of Midway, The Naval Institute Guide to the U.S. Navy's Greatest Victory. I'm your host, Rob Havers, and this program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago and is sponsored by the United States Naval Institute. This program and hundreds more covering a full range of military topics is available on demand at pritzkermilitary.org. The Battle of Midway, commemorated annually by the U.S. Navy, warrants close attention. While many know that the June 1942 battle was a crucial American victory, they often do not know the details of Midway. When the U.S. Navy stopped the Japanese steamroller off Midway Island, it not only turned the progress of the war, but set the Navy's foundation for future counter-offensives. The Navy's comeback spread to the Solomon Islands and onto other key strategic areas in the Pacific. The Battle of Midway focuses on the events leading up to the battle and the battle itself, but also includes a section which examines how others have interpreted the battle's often desperate engagements. From the enlisted man's perspective all the way to the admirals, for both Americans and Japanese, Hone provides readers the opportunity to see the U.S. Navy's greatest victory as the participants saw it. Thomas C. Hone is a former senior executive in the Office of the Secretary of Defense and a former member of the faculty of the Naval War College with a PhD from the University of Wisconsin. He is the author or co-author of three books on naval administration and innovation, the co-author of a book on the Navy between the World Wars, and an award-winning author of articles and essays on naval and military affairs. Please join me in welcoming Tom Hone to the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.
Good evening. I want to begin by thanking the staff of the Pritzker Military Museum for the help they've given me in putting together this presentation and for their wonderful hospitality today and this evening. I want to begin by reminding everybody that the book in question is an anthology. It's a collection of material first published in either an article or a book that was issued by the United States Naval Institute Press. So it's really an effort by the United States Naval Institute to put out in the open a lot of material, some of which dates back to the late 1940s. I have to say something about the anthology because I put it together. I put it together because I wanted something for the young lieutenants working in a command when it came time every June 4th to commemorate the victory of the United States Navy at the Battle of Midway. I know how this works, having been on several Navy staffs. The captain or the admiral is reminded by his staff that this day of celebration is here and it's time to do something. So the word goes out, and usually it's a young lieutenant, he or she, who has to try to put something together so that the boss can talk sensibly and in an important way about this very dramatic victory. So I tried to include material that could be used for that purpose. So if you read the book, by all means keep that in mind. It was written not only for you, but especially for the young officers who often get asked or directed to prepare material for Navy commemorations. It was difficult to put the book together in a way because the Naval Institute wanted me to use their publications. I cheated on them in two ways, in two cases. First, at the end of the book, there is an appendix, which is in fact the after part of the after action report from the carrier USS Enterprise for the day June 4th, the really crucial day of the Battle of Midway. I took that right out of the National Archives. I also took pieces of the after action report of the PT boat squadron that was based in Midway. They were very active, surprisingly active. And in fact, on the 5th of June, after the critical day of June 4th, were sent out hunting for any Japanese ships that might have been damaged, but they could not keep up with the rest of the Japanese fleet. I was amazed at this. It's like sending mosquitoes out to go after a bear. I want to begin by talking about the strategy of the Japanese. The strategy was pretty clear. It was to push aside, in the Pacific, the forces of the United States and the forces of Great Britain, the forces of Holland and France, so that the Japanese could take the former colonies that were claimed and administered by these countries. That was really the purpose. It was to buy time for Japanese forces to conquer these areas and subdue them and then turn them into assets for the Japanese Empire. So that's really what happens. The Japanese start with a flurry of activity, trying to defeat, put off, deter, disable, disarm their opponents. I always try to tell people to put themselves into the place of Admiral Yamamoto, who was the commander-in-chief of the Japanese confined fleet. He's rather like somebody who walks into a bar and suspects that things might get very rough very quickly. And if that has ever happened to you, I won't ask for any hands, but if that has ever happened to you, the first thing you have to do is figure out who your enemies are, who the other guys are. And the second thing you have to do almost immediately is bring your opponents down to your size, down to your strength. You want to get the advantage. And that's exactly what Admiral Yamamoto proposed to do. He and his staff designed a lightning campaign, extraordinary campaign, really starting on 7 December 1941 with the attack on the U.S. fleet at Pearl Harbor, which was really a raid on Hawaii. At the time, there were people in Hawaii who were afraid the Japanese were going to invade Oahu or invade the Hawaiian Islands. That was not in the plan. The plan was simply to push the United States fleet off the stage. And then Yamamoto took his forces and continued to do that, starting at Midway, rolling all the way across the Pacific, down to the Philippines, down into the Dutch East Indies, over into the waters off Malaya, and finally into the Sea of Bengal on the coast of India. This is an extraordinary event. But that's what I'm going to talk about this. Now, there was something else they wanted to do, which is rarely mentioned, but I think is very important, and I want to mention it to you. It is that the Japanese hoped in using this offensive and making it a success to isolate China. They'd been at war with the Chinese since 1937, real war, terrible war. But the Chinese were getting help from the outside, and it was coming up through places like Burma. And so the Japanese attack was not only done to push away the colonial powers, it was also done to isolate China. So it was a series of raids. Pearl Harbor was a raid. It's usually seen as a major attack. It was in fact a major raid. The Japanese came, attacked the fleet at anchor, and left. This is Arizona. I'm sure all of you have seen photographs like this one. Then the Japanese they had come east, then they turned around and went west to try to eliminate British forces. And this is a photograph taken by a Japanese airplane of Prince of Wales and Repulse, a battleship and a battlecruiser, who were sunk by Japanese land-based naval air. The Japanese had carrier aircraft, but they also had attack aircraft based on land. And these air squadrons were very professional. They stayed professional all the way through the war. They were still a threat to American naval forces in 1944. But on 10 December 1941, they, in a sense, exterminated any threat from the British in the waters near Singapore. This is Cavite Navy Base. This is the base near Manila in the Philippine Islands. And again, what the Japanese were trying to do was simply make sure that their forces would have control of the sea and the air around the Philippines, because they intended to conquer the Philippines and occupy the archipelago. They were successful, very successful indeed. U.S. forces held out in parts of the Philippine Islands, but they had to surrender on 8 May 1942. This was actually not the date that the Japanese aimed at. They wanted to conquer the Philippines at least a month before that, but the U.S. Army, along with the Philippine Constabulary, held out until 8 May when they had to surrender. I mention this because, again, what the Japanese did was to build an offensive that would move from place to place with great speed and allow their forces to come in behind the attack, aerial attacks, and occupy islands and bases all across the Western Pacific. Their first real defeat, I'm going to call it a defeat because it was at the operational level a defeat, was at the Battle of the Coral Sea in the waters between Australia and New Guinea. That was 7 and 8 May. Notice the relationship between the surrender in the Philippines and the Battle of the Coral Sea. The Japanese sent a carrier force to try to wipe out any defensive air power in that area based in Australia. The U.S. Navy sent two carriers and a task force against them. And what you see in this photograph is the United States carrier Lexington, a big carrier, which was heavily bombed and torpedoed by the Japanese and had to be abandoned. You could see the fire that consumed the ship. The carrier Yorktown, which was with Lexington, was also seriously damaged, but it made it back to Pearl Harbor. And when it got to Pearl Harbor, it was inspected personally by the commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet, Admiral Chester Nimitz. Nimitz was an engineer, a naval engineer. And the initial estimate of repairs to carrier Yorktown was that it would take a month to 6 weeks to get her back in shape and get her into the water again as a fighting unit. Nimitz said, you have 48 hours. And the dock workers, the ship fitters and the like, in Hawaii, in Pearl Harbor, were able to do that. And they were able to get Yorktown back into the water. Now, why did this matter? It mattered because the Japanese were going to bring four carriers to the battle. They had had six at Pearl Harbor, but two had been either damaged or their air crews had been decimated at the Battle of the Coral Sea. So the Japanese carrier force approaching Midway had four carriers. Nimitz wanted to make it four against four. So he had three carriers, Enterprise, Hornet, the new Hornet, and now a repaired Yorktown, and he had a stationary carrier called Midway, called the Island of Midway. So this was the setup for Midway. And what it suggested to Admiral Yamamoto was that the Japanese had to make another effort, a strong effort, to pull the United States fleet into combat while the Japanese fleet outnumbered it and destroy the U.S. fleet to buy time. That is exactly what Admiral Yamamoto wanted to do. That was his task, buy time, so that the Japanese could build a set of defensive bases to keep the United States away. Well, that started to get upset at the Battle of the Coral Sea, where the Japanese lost a significant piece of their air strength. This was one of their carriers, a light carrier, Shoho. You can see, I can't point it out here in the picture, but if you look in the sort of the lower right-hand corner, you will see an American aircraft, which has just attacked this Japanese vessel. The doctrine of the United States Navy with regard to carrier warfare, and indeed with regard to all naval warfare, was that the advantage in campaigns goes to the side that's on the offensive and stays on the offensive. I'll give the game away right here for the whole presentation. the United States Navy took the initiative away from the Japanese Navy at the Battle of Midway. The Japanese Navy never got it back. So it was just a matter of time and good planning and very brave activity and fighting that would bring the Japanese Navy to defeat. This was the same doctrine the Japanese had. You had two navies, both very professional, both well-trained, and the approach each navy took to the war was to go on the offensive, stay on the offensive, and be as aggressive as possible. And so what Admiral Yamamoto wanted to do was to use Midway as bait, draw the rest of the U.S. fleet out, and destroy it. He had one problem. He had several, as it turned out, but one very big problem. He said this in his report of the battle, his report of the planning for the battle. The enemy is not aware of our plans. Well, the enemy was. I'm sure a lot of you know about that. I mean, one of the great events in military history in the last two generations has been a set of revelations about the code breaking. Intercepted messages and the decryption and so forth. This was extremely important. So when the commander of the Japanese striking force at Midway said to himself, the Navy is not aware of our plans, he was setting it up for a defeat. Now, you see, I've also listed underneath there, time is everything on this slide. Time is everything. That's what all the carrier commanders knew, whether they were Japanese or American. Time was everything. You had to find the enemy and strike the enemy before the enemy could strike you. Because when the enemy did, the enemy would strike you with a pulse of power that you could probably not resist. That was the state of carrier warfare in 1942. If the enemy got his planes to your carrier, the chances were good he would either seriously damage your carrier or destroy it. Carrier warfare was often compared to warfare between two armed men, two men armed with knives in a dark room. The one that bumped into the other first and knew what he'd done and could strike was the winner. I've listed the commanders there. That's Vice Admiral Nagumo on the left, Rear Admiral Fletcher, Frank Fletcher in the center, and Rear Admiral Raymond Spruance on the right. The United States Navy had two task forces, Task Force 16, Task Force 17, two carriers in one carrier in the other, and these were the commanders of those task forces. What Admiral Nimitz did, Nimitz really directed the battle, set it up, I'll say, from Hawaii. What he did was he gave the information that had been obtained by the code breakers and the people doing traffic analysis, he gave that information to his subordinate admirals, put them in the right position, and told them to win. As it turned out, they did. Now, why? That's the question. Why? To do that, to explain that to you, I've got to go through a timeline for the day of 4 June 1942. I've got to take you through it. I was asked to give this presentation, and I thought very hard about a way to get around it. You know, is there a movie? What could I do? How do I show something that's really complex and get people to understand it without confusing them at the same time? That was my task. I'm not sure if I've solved it, but I'm going to give it a try right here. By the way, there are some movies about Midway. John Ford, the famous Hollywood director, did a movie, The Battle of Midway. It's the best propaganda film of World War II. And part of it was filmed on Midway Island. He was there. He was injured. By the Japanese when they bombed the island. And there are some actual photographs, film, of activity on the American carriers. There was a Battle of Midway movie. Does anybody remember that? Charlton Heston? Don't ever watch it again. Hollywood can get things wrong. Hollywood really got that one wrong. They tried, but they got it wrong. So stay away from that. I think it would be wonderful if somebody did a film on Midway that was really accurate, that put in the film everything we now know about what happened, because some younger historians have done a great job with Japanese colleagues in opening up the Japanese side to it. Well, let me take you to June 4th, 1942. It's a beautiful day. Really is. Beautiful day in the Pacific, 1,100 miles from Hawaii. Beautiful day, beautiful blue ocean, and it's time to kill one another. How do I want to put this? I'm going to start you with the day. I'm going to carry you through this one day. A little after 6 o'clock in the morning, 6:15, 6:16, Japanese aircraft launched from the four aircraft carriers that they had attacked Midway, attacked the base there. There are two islands that really form the base, and they bombed both of them. Radar on those islands detected the approaching Japanese and all the aircraft that were there, and there were a lot of aircraft there, about 120. There were 18 B-17s on these two small islands. There were four B-26 twin-engine bombers. There were a bunch of American seaplanes anchored in the lagoon. Well, they all took off. They were all sent off to find the Japanese and attack them. So the Japanese show up a little after 6 o'clock in the morning, and they proceed to bomb Midway. They're done with their attack about 10 minutes to 7. And at 7 o'clock, as the Japanese airplanes come together to organize themselves to go back to their carriers, the commander of the strike, the Japanese commander, signals to Admiral Nagumo that there's a need for a second strike. Time to do a second strike. Now, while that's going on, the two American carriers, Enterprise and Hornet, are launching aircraft. And this is not something that happens like this. It doesn't in the carriers of that time, because they're launching off a bunch of airplanes together, and they have to send some off, and those have to wait while the others come up so that they can depart in a group, because as a group, they're powerful. Not one at a time, not six or 10 at a time, but as a group. That's how they overwhelm the defenses. So at a little after 7 o'clock, these two carriers begin launching their aircraft. Now, the Japanese aircraft are approaching the Japanese carriers, hoping to get home. This is home for them. At the same time, the airplanes who took off from Midway, including the B-17s, they're searching for the Japanese. So you've got these air groups moving together at the same time. At about 7:15, Admiral Nagumo gets the message saying that there should be a second strike, and he orders his reserve aircraft, which are held in the hangars of his carriers, to be rearmed. Take the torpedoes off. Those are good against ships. We're going to go back to an island. So you take the torpedoes off, you put bombs on. Well, that causes a lot of work for the crews down inside the hangar. And you know, they're under a lot of pressure to get this done and get it done as quickly as possible. One of the things they tend to do is not to take the torpedoes that they've had put on their torpedo planes and send them back to the magazines, the torpedo magazines. Instead, they stack them to the side of the hangar. That will turn out to be a disastrous move in just a little time. At about 7:30, one of the scout aircraft launched by the Japanese cruisers, who are part of Nagumo's force, detects American ships. And 15 minutes later, after sort of looking through the information from that airplane, Nagumo says, okay, attack that force. The Americans are here, let's go get them. But 10 minutes after that, airplanes from Midway show up, you know, B-17s, B-26s, and various kinds of aircraft from Midway, including some new Avenger torpedo bombers. They start showing up. The airplanes from Midway don't come out as one group. They come out as small clusters. Cluster one, cluster two, cluster three. Each of these clusters is vulnerable to the combat air patrol of Japanese fighters. But what they do is they force Nagumo to cycle his fighters, his combat air patrol, through his carrier decks, right? They're up there protecting his carriers. Well, fuel gets short, so they come back. And another group takes off to take their place. So he is constantly cycling aircraft along his flight decks, usually in groups of three, to go up and supplement and augment his combat air patrol. This is going on for a long time because the airplanes from Midway keep streaming out. At about 8:30, the Japanese carriers begin recovering the aircraft, their aircraft, returning from Midway. So all of this stuff is almost happening all at once. The Japanese aircraft from Midway are coming in. They're running out of gas. They need to land. While they're landing, Nagumo's carriers can't bring up the aircraft for the strike. They want to send off a strike on this contact. They can't do it because they have to recover their own airplanes. Between 9:30 and 10 o'clock in the morning, all the torpedo planes from the American carriers attack. There were 41 of them. They came from three of the carriers, from Hornet and Enterprise in Yorktown. 41 of them attack the four Japanese carriers. Only six of them survive. All the others are shot down. They don't get any hits. And torpedoes were the main threat to a ship, a surface ship, a carrier, whatever it happened to be. So that effort fails. It fails because those airplanes come in without adequate escort. But at about 25 minutes after 10, when the Japanese are beginning to think that maybe they're going to get a break, dive bombers from Yorktown and Enterprise show up. And these, let me go back. This is what you see right here. This is it. They show up. The Japanese Combat Air Patrol has been attacking the torpedo bombers that have come in. That's brought the Combat Air Patrol down from high altitude down near the surface. And suddenly, at high altitude, the American dive bombers show up. There's a note in one of the testimonies of one of the Japanese survivors who was standing on the deck of one of the carriers. I think it was Akagi. And he said one of the flight deck crewmen shouted something and pointed up. And he looked up and he could see the American dive bombers peeling off for their attack. He was a professional. He knew they were. And he said, "We've had it." So that's what happened. So in the space of about 5 minutes, the Japanese turn from a situation where they're getting ready to launch their next strike and getting ready to win the Battle of Midway. They lose three of the four carriers that they have in about 5 minutes. They're not sunk, but they're so badly damaged and set on fire that they're not effective as fighting units. There's one Japanese carrier left. It's the Hiryu. And it somehow was missed by the American dive bombers. They didn't find it. And it launches a strike at 11 o'clock in the morning. At noon, its dive bombers attack the carrier Yorktown, hit it with three bombs. It's on fire. It comes almost to a stop. And the Japanese return to their carrier. They return to Hiryu and say, "We got that one." All right? But as it happens, the sailors on Yorktown repair as much of the damage as they can, put the fires out, and they get Yorktown steaming again so that she can recover and launch aircraft. In the meantime, the Hiryu dive bombers have gotten back to their carrier, and they're put down into the hangars, and at 1:30 in the afternoon, their carrier launches the second strike with torpedo planes. They find Yorktown. All right, there are two other carriers. They don't know they're there. They find Yorktown. They think it is a second carrier. They don't realize it's the one that's already been hit. So they attack it, and they put two torpedoes into it. At about 2:45, scouts from the carrier Enterprise find Hiryu. Enterprise launches a strike at about 3:30, and by 4:30, the Hiryu is bombed and wrecked. She's turned into a wreck by those dive bombers. This is basically what happens in one day. The Japanese start that day with four carriers, with some of the best pilots and air crew in the world. And by 5 o'clock or 5:30 in the afternoon, those four carriers have been wrecked. Now, Yorktown has been torpedoed and bombed and is a sinking condition, and the question is whether she can be saved. There was an effort made to save her. There was no tug available to try to tow her out of danger, and she was found on the 6th of June, not on the 4th or the 5th, but on the 6th of June, by a Japanese submarine, which sank her and accompanying destroyer. So this is it. This is what you have to get in your head when you think about the Battle of Midway. I always suggest to people, put yourself in the position of Admiral Nagumo. You're on the bridge of your flagship, Akagi. It's a great big aircraft carrier, the favorite of the fleet. You're on the bridge, and what happens to you? It's right here. The Americans rob you of time. This is a picture taken from a B-17. It shows Akagi, almost obscured by clouds, in the lower right-hand corner. There's a escort destroyer trying to turn with her. She's going to avoid the attacks by the B-17s, but she gets clobbered by the dive bombers. And the reason is Nagumo is robbed of time. He has to get his airplanes from Midway back aboard, put down in the hangar. He has to bring the aircraft that are in the hangar up to the flight deck and get them off. He can't do it because he's attacked and he's attacked and he's attacked. His defenses push away every one of the attacks except the last one by the dive bombers. So there it is. On 4 June, 4 Japanese carriers are lost. 1 U.S. Navy carrier's lost from attacks on 4 and 7 June. Now, these are paintings. There was a photographer on Yorktown who took some interesting photographs. I have copies of a couple of them. They're terrible because he went into the water, right? He abandoned ship, took his camera with him. And so the photographs are just salt water spattered. They're terrible. So that's why I'm using paintings. The one on the left was published in Japan. I obtained it from a Japanese antique dealer. And it shows Yorktown being attacked by Japanese aircraft and sinking. And that was true, that Yorktown was attacked and damaged and basically sunk by Japanese air forces. The painting on the right shows the dive bombers from Enterprise speeding away from their attacks on the Japanese carriers. At this time, in June 1942, most aircraft carriers were floating volcanoes. Okay, they had a lot of aviation gas. That's high-octane gasoline. They had a lot of ordnance. And as I told you, the Japanese, in trying to get their reserve aircraft loaded for a strike against U.S. carriers, first, when they were told they were going to attack Midway, first they took the torpedoes off. Then they were trying to put them back on to those attack aircraft. So you had a lot of ordnance around. And the bombs from the dive bombers, the American dive bombers, set that ordnance off and also started terrible fires inside those ships. That was always the danger with aircraft carriers. To some degree, it is still a danger. I'm going to finish. The Pacific War was not over, not at all. In fact, the Japanese Navy thought that the Guadalcanal campaign, which lasted for months, was more critical than the Battle of Midway to them. But they lost the initiative, and they never got it back. It was the United States that decided what would happen and when. That's what it says here. The Pacific War was not over, but the Japanese Navy had lost the initiative, and the Japanese Navy would never regain it. This picture is from your airport here at Midway. And this is a dive bomber, American dive bomber, like the ones that were used then. It's a very interesting battle. The Navy commemorates it every year. A lot of people don't know much about it. The key day is the fourth day of June, 1942, but it's a day that it's difficult to describe because so much is happening at the same time. Airplanes are going back and forth. The Midway airplanes go out to find the Japanese. They don't do much damage, but they keep Admiral Nagumo from having the time he needs to set up his strike against the American carriers. So they go out. The stragglers, the survivors, come back. And so you have these airplanes going out, coming back the whole day, whether they're Japanese airplanes or American airplanes. And one more thing I want to say, most of the Japanese pilots were saved, even though most of their aircraft were lost. The real loss that hurt the Japanese Navy in the succeeding months, the real loss were the sailors who worked in the hangars, the armorers, the mechanics, the flight deck crews. most of them enlisted. These were the people that kept the airplanes flying. These are the people who got the airplanes off the deck, and they got the airplanes back. And hundreds of them were killed. The Japanese casualties were over 3,000. The American casualties significantly less, closer to 300. So there was that difference. But it's not the numbers that matter. It's who was lost. Now, one more thing. Do I have time for one more thing? After the battle, the Japanese Navy hid the results even from the Japanese Army. The survivors in the Japanese Navy were taken back to Japan. Those who were injured were put in special hospitals and not allowed to see their families. The others were parceled out, sent out to different parts of the war zone. It was a very, very sad situation. That is, imagine you survive the Battle of Midway. You've been working on one of these aircraft carriers. Your carrier is bombed and succumbs to fire. You go into the water. You get picked up. You get taken back to the home country. And you're told you're not going to be able to see your family because you will tell them that your carrier was bombed. And the Japanese government didn't want this information out. Even inside the Japanese government, this information was held closely. The United States Navy didn't reveal the sinking of Yorktown until September 1942, but the government of the United States did admit that. The Japanese government tried to keep it from not only from the Japanese people, but from the Japanese Army, so the Japanese Army would not realize how significant the defeat was for the Japanese Navy. Well, that is the end of my presentation. And if there are questions or comments, I'm happy to hear them. I do want to say one thing. There is a lot of literature on Midway, a lot of good literature, a lot of good books. And in fact, the Naval Institute has published a number of them. And I was able to draw on those books for this anthology. But I'm sure there are people here who know a great deal about the battle. I'm also sure there may be a few people who know hardly anything about the battle. And I've tried to, you know, tailor my comments to tell you something, whichever group you're in. But if you have questions, by all means, I'd be happy to answer them.
Would you mind talking a little bit more about your anthology and some of the, you know, it has perspectives from the Japanese and Americans, and sometimes some that might have differed from the historical record. Can you speak to any of those?
Oh, I can.
Yeah.
I wanted to add some things to the anthology that had not been published by the Naval Institute Press. But the press said, no, we want you to use what we have published in our articles and our books. Well, there has been in recent times, about the last 10 or 15 years, some new scholarship on the Japanese side, so that a lot more is known now about what the Japanese did than was known, say, in 1950 or 1980 or even 1990. And it was difficult to get this into the anthology because the writers of that literature really want people to read it. They didn't want me to take the juicy parts of it and put it in the anthology. I mean, that's the danger with an anthology. You're looking for the things that matter. You want to put them in there, but at the same time, you don't want somebody to come along, buy the anthology, or just read the anthology and say, well, I know this, and I know that, and I don't need to read any more. The point to it is to encourage people to explore other sources, not to stop them from doing so. So there is still a material coming out on Midway. Still some material being found in Japan, some records that were saved about the airplanes and what they did on the Japanese side. I haven't been able to keep up with that, but there are some younger researchers who do a fine job, and they do it via the internet from Japan to the United States. So there is still some room to learn more about what happened in this battle and why it happened the way it did.
I noticed that you had an excerpt from someone commenting on how the British commemorate Trafalgar Battle of Trafalgar.
Yes.
And the comparison between that and how Midway is commemorated here. Now, that article is a little dated, maybe 2003. And I'm wondering, do you have any comments on that? And is there any effort, have there been any effort to make it more commemorative here?
Yes. Midway is celebrated. June 4th is celebrated every year inside the United States Navy, officially, as a commemoration of the battle. And again, that's one reason I did the anthology, so that the young staff officer being told, get something ready for the commemoration, would have something to draw on. And I felt there was enough material in the book for that to happen. I also wanted that parts of that article about is Midway the American Trafalgar? To, you know, is it? And my own view is that it's not the same. Trafalgar gave the Royal Navy command of the sea for almost a century. Midway simply stopped the Japanese. And that was it. That was the end of their rolling offensive. But they fought tenaciously until the end of the war. I mean, the Japanese Navy was an extraordinary organization. Not necessarily one I would have wanted to have been a part of. For example, the Japanese fished out of the water some American aviators at Midway. They tortured them, extracted information from them, and then tied gasoline cans filled with water around their necks, tied their hands, and threw them overboard. And if that isn't a war crime, I don't know what is. If you belong to a force where this, a military force, a Navy, where this behavior is accepted, then, you know, that's something that certainly bothers me a great deal. The United States Navy was able to pick up some Japanese sailors. There were some from Carrier Hiryu. There were almost 30 of them in a lifeboat. And they managed to survive for, I think, about 2 weeks, almost 2 weeks. And they were found and picked up. And they thought they were all going to be killed immediately. And they were terribly surprised that that didn't happen, that they were interrogated and then shipped back to the United States to be prisoners of war. Does that help? I hope so.
Several years ago, I remember there was a controversy whether Butch O'Hare was shot down at Midway by friendly fire. How was that resolved, do you know?
Well, actually, O'Hare was a pilot, famous fighter pilot for the U.S. Navy. And he was killed in a battle later in the war, not at Midway. But yeah, one of the problems you have with any military engagement, especially if it's one like Midway, where so much is going on at once, is that you may have a lot of friendly fire. You may have that. And that can happen to either side. But for example, I'll give you an illustration of how you get around it. The Navy had those Catalina seaplanes, which they used for reconnaissance. And when the Japanese went in to attack Midway on the morning of June the 4th, there were some of those reconnaissance aircraft coming back from their long patrols. Well, they didn't land. They didn't land in the two central islands of the Midway Atoll. Somebody had thought about what might happen, and so there were stations for them to go to land in the water and tie up and wait at a distance until the battle was over.
Does your book touch on any code-breaking stuff?
Or? Yeah, this is really interesting. Remember that the code-breakers who worked for the commander of the 14th Naval District, that was Hawaii, they had not predicted Pearl Harbor. They were caught by surprise. And so there was a feeling in Washington that they might not be very good, that they might not be able to do what they said they could do. And remember, it's not just code breaking, it's also something called traffic analysis, which simply watches who communicates with whom and when. And so one of the things that Rochefort, Commander Rochefort, and his subordinates had to do was to convince Admiral Nimitz that they had intercepted the Japanese communications, they had been able to decipher the Japanese code, and that it would tell them something right? That this was very important, and that they could go to Nimitz and tell him when the Japanese would attack, what day they would attack, and they got it exactly right. But they had to convince him of that. And they were able to do so with the cooperation of his staff intelligence officer, a commander, lieutenant commander by the name of Edwin Layton. And Rochefort and Layton set up a private phone line where they could talk to one another. And they knew what they had to do. They were gathering information. They had to interpret that information properly. They had to get Nimitz to pay attention to it and act on it. And they were able to do that. And that's something I made sure the book covered. There's a good book about it, and I pulled sections out of that book and put it in the anthology. Because it's very important. People forget Pearl Harbor was a surprise attack. Does that mean there was no code breaking going on in Hawaii? No, it doesn't. There's a reason why that happened, right? But because it happened, you have this tension. Imagine you're Admiral Nimitz. You got to win this battle. Admiral King has told you to win it. This is it. Are your code breakers, traffic analysts, and intelligence people, are they going to give you the right information? And they had to persuade Nimitz. They had to show him the trail that they had followed to get this information, and they were able to do so. But they had to be very smart, very good, very persuasive. And I think that movie with Charlton Heston missed that point completely. Probably because the screenwriter didn't know about this stuff. I mean, you know, if you're going to be a screenwriter, you need to know something. But if nobody's told you about it, or you haven't read it, then you sort of make something up. The movies are a form often of fiction. I often think of politics as being similar. But in the military, it's something like World War II. You can't go that way. Midway was critical, absolutely critical. Stop the Japanese. Admiral Nimitz saved his job. He saved his job. If he had lost that battle, and you know, he's responsible for it. He said that. If he had lost that battle, it would have been the end of his career. And it might have had a very serious long-term effect on the war in the Pacific. My son has been here to talk, and he's a war gamer. He started that when he was young. I don't know how that bug bit him, but it did. And so when he was in high school, he and his friends were doing these war games. I said, I want you to war game. What would have happened in the Pacific if the Japanese had won at Midway? So I had information for them, and you know, they needed something to do. It was the winter. So they did. And what they discovered was that the war in the Pacific takes another year, with the attendant loss of life. So Midway saved time, and it saved a lot of human lives on both sides, but especially on the American side. So, but again, getting back to this whole business about the code breaking, that was essential. And it was also essential that the Japanese not learn that that had happened. And one of the things that made it possible for the United States Navy to hide what it was doing was the cable, the submarine cable from Midway to Hawaii. That cable dated back, I think, to 1906 or something like this, submarine cable. And so a lot of the communication between Hawaii and Midway was done on the cable, not on radio. And the radio they used then was high frequency, right? And all of you know what HF is, right? When you broadcast high frequency, where does it go? Everywhere. So what all navies had this problem. High frequency radio communications were a benefit to navies. All navies embraced them. There was also an Achilles heel, because your contact would want to hear, right, and would hear, but somebody else could overhear and could figure out what you were doing. So that led to this growth of code development, developing codes, encryption, and then, of course, you had decryption, people trying to break the codes. But all that was hidden. One of the things I tried to do when I was doing the anthology was find a note in the National Archives where the Navy says, we are procuring machines from companies like National Cash Register and IBM. We're procuring this equipment so that we can do better traffic analysis
and assess intercepted messages, you know, group them, figure out what they mean. I looked for that in the National Archives, couldn't find it. The Navy hid it. They just hid that. That was so secret. And it paid off. Paid off brilliantly.
Mine is about a two-part question. One is, do you have an estimate or maybe even the actual number of support vessels that were involved at the Battle of Midway? And does the anthology cover their activities as well?
The answer, I'm sorry to say, is no and no. I don't have all the numbers. I don't know how many there were on both sides, by the way. For example, the Japanese, in steaming from Japan to Midway, had to refuel going and coming, and they did so from tankers at sea. This is not easy to do. The Americans had all sorts of support vessels out in Hawaii. They even took over tuna boats to use them as pickets in case the Japanese, they would encounter the Japanese. I mentioned the PT boats. There was a PT boat squadron based in Hawaii at Pearl Harbor. On the 4th of June, two of those PT boats were out at an island called Kure, about 60 miles away from Midway. And the next day after the battle, the commander in Hawaii of the 14th Naval District said he was going to send the rest of those, the other eight torpedo boats, seven or eight, out there to search for any Japanese ships that had been damaged and were slow or could be caught by PT boats. And it's fascinating to read the report of the executive officer of the PT boat squadron, because between the lines, what you see is the fact that they were all young. These are all 21-year-old, 19-year-old sailors. What do they want to do? They want to attack the Japanese. So between the lines, you see this sense of, they sent us, and darn it, we didn't find them because they'd already left. What they would have found if they had encountered the Japanese ships, and there were two Japanese cruisers, for example, that were damaged and were moving slowly back to Japan. If those PT boats had found the cruisers, they might not have come out of it alive, but they were ready to go. So there was all this activity. Tankers were important, ammunition ships important, tenders, destroyer tenders, submarine tenders, repair ships, all of these ships mattered a great deal. Unfortunately, nobody wrote about them for the Naval Institute. And the Naval Institute said, we want you to use our material. And in fact, I've never seen a good article on the support ships for either fleet. It's something, if any of you, if you're a young scholar, this is your chance. No. Find out what these ships were, how they were organized, and so forth. I know a little bit about it, but not enough. And to really get the story, you'd have to dig into the naval archives of both countries.
I've been led to believe that there'll never be another naval battle in the history of the world similar to the Battle of Midway. Though we may have not wiped the Japanese fleet off of the Pacific, I think, again, there will never be another naval battle such as Midway.
Well, we could take a poll of the audience to see what the rest of you think. I had a hand when I worked for the Navy Department in developing missiles, anti-ship missiles mostly, like Harpoon and Tomahawk. And what's been happening in the last 10 years or so is that the major navies of the world have been getting more effective sensors, detectors, things that find, whether they're satellites or unmanned aerial vehicles, whatever they may be, they can find ships at sea. And then you can attack these ships, sometimes with missiles that come in at very high speeds, sometimes even now with ballistic missiles. Chinese have a ballistic missile that can attack ships at sea. Whether it's really that accurate or not, nobody knows. But that changes the nature of naval battles. It means that if they occur at all, they may happen very quickly. They may start and finish in a matter of hours. And at the end of that time, the two sides, if there are just two sides, they may be out of the ammunition that they want to use, the missiles. Missiles are extraordinary things. I speak as one who helped develop and field them. But they're not cheap, and they're not easy to make quickly. And so there are only so many in the inventory of any navy. Only so many. This sort of happened at Midway. The two navies ran out of airplanes. Of course, the Japanese lost four carriers. But by the 6th of June, the Navy, U.S. Navy carriers, the two survivors, were down to three torpedo planes. That's it. Fortunately, that day, a carrier Saratoga, a big carrier, came in from California with her deck full of aircraft. But there was a real concern in Hawaii, because remember, there's another battle going on besides Midway. It's up in the Aleutians. Read about that if you get a chance. It's an extraordinary series of events where the Japanese send forces up to attack the Aleutian Islands, and they, in fact, occupy two of them. And the U.S. Navy can't stop them from doing so, because the U.S. Navy is so limited in terms of the resources that it has. And so, you know, it's an extraordinary. Carrier Saratoga comes in. There are pictures in the National Archives showing her flight deck loaded with airplanes. Those are essential reinforcements. Any future naval battle will be like that. The outcome may be determined by how quickly replacement airplanes, torpedoes, whatever, missiles, reach the fighting forces.
Thank you to Tom Hone for a great discussion, and thank you to the United States Naval Institute for sponsoring this program of Pritzker Military Presents. To learn more about the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, visit us in person or online at pritzkermilitary.org. Thank you, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Visit the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. Explore original exhibits on military history or be a part of a live studio audience. Watch other episodes of Pritzker Military Presents. Find out what's on at PritzkerMilitary.org. Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the Museum and Library. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.